A few weeks back, we spoke about the murder of Emmett Till and what it meant to the civil rights movement. But history tends to repeat itself.
Emmett Till wasn't the only racially motivated murder in the summer of 1955 in Mississippi.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a story about a lesser-known casualty of the Jim Crow South. We'll also hear about the new World Almanac Book of Facts and spend an academic minute finding a future for students with disabilities. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Almost 67 years ago, a photograph was published that shocked the nation, the image of 14-year-old Emmett Till's murdered body. On August 28, 1955, Till was visiting family in the Mississippi Delta when he was kidnapped, horribly beaten, and killed by white men after allegedly flirting with a white woman. His body was later found in the Tallahatchie River. Emmett Till's death became a media sensation. Today, it's considered a spark that helped fuel the civil rights movement. But few people know that there was another brazen murder of a black man that happened just 3 months later in a neighboring town in the Delta. Clinton Melton was shot and killed in broad daylight by a white man who had also taken part in Emmett Till's death. The program Radio Diaries brings us the story.
My name is Dolores Melton Gresham. I'm the daughter of Clinton Melton and Beulah Melton.
My name is Darcy White, Jr. I'm 86 years old. I am Beulah's nephew.
Growing up, the house that we lived in, it was like on a little bayou. Like, it was always a happy home. My mom, she was a beautiful woman. Her nickname was Pretty Mama. This is what everybody called
her. Clinton Melton was what you call a good man. He worked hard, took care of his family. He was, you know, well-respected by all of the black people that knew him, and the white people that came in contact with him, they liked him also.
My dad worked at a service station. He pumped gas, fixed flats. We used to stand and wait for him to come home. And, you know, even though we couldn't tell time, we knew what time he was supposed to be coming home.
Glendora, Mississippi was a little small plantation town, just a little whistle stop on Highway 49. You know, at that time, you didn't have any protection as far as the laws were concerned. It could just happen any time. You could be pulled over by highway patrolmen if you were driving a car and be abused. Any old white person could, you know, start trouble and no one would interfere. I guess you felt like a rabbit in the forest, really, what you felt like. because you didn't have nobody to run to.
This is W.F. Minor, Times-Picayune, Jackson, Mississippi. The kidnapping of Emmett Till, the 14-year-old who disappeared on August 28th.
I was 20 years old when Emmett Till was killed. You know, it was the news of the day.
Two white men.
The kids at school would talk about Emmett Till and how they had thrown his body into the river. I remember being afraid to go to sleep at night because some white people might come in and do the same thing to my brothers.
The brutal lynching of Emmett Till demands prosecution of all persons for the heinous crime.
Emmett Till wasn't the only racially motivated murder that took place in the summer of 1955 in Mississippi. But Emmett was the perfect poster child. My name is Keith Beauchamp, and I made the documentary, The Untold Story of Emmett Louis Till. After the Till murder trial, you have two men who was involved with the murder of Emmett Till, Roy Bryant and J.W. Milam, and they are acquitted of all the charges by an all-white, all-male jury. And then they get to stand in front of the cameras and smoke cigars and so on. They would get off scot-free.
My name is Dave Tell, and I'm the author of Remembering Emmett Till. The acquittal fueled this environment, this sense that violence against Black Americans would never be punished.
Something was bound to happen again. And 3 months later, just a few miles away, a 34-year-old gin operator drove to a gas station in Glendora, Mississippi.
On that day, Elmer Kimball was driving the car of his good friend, J.W. Milam, one of the confessed murderers of Emmett Till.
They were friends, you know. They would hang out together, the Kimballs and the Milams. I guess they'd be drinking beer. So it was late in the afternoon near closing time when Kimball parked the car near the gasoline pump. Clinton approached him, and they told him to put the gasoline in.
So my dad filled the car up with gas, and then when he had finished, he told me, that, you know, okay, you're finished. And he said, no, I didn't tell you to fill it up. I want $2 worth. And my dad told me, he said, I distinctly heard you say you wanted a fill-up.
That's when the dispute came. They said he didn't put the right amount in there. So he told him again, said, well, I put in there what you told me.
And he told my father, well, don't be here when I get back. And so when he told him that, the service station owner told my father, Clinton, just go home, you know.
Clinton started putting some fuel in his car so he could go home. And before he finished, they returned.
When he came back with the gun, he shot in the car. From what I was told, he had a bullet hole in his hand and a bullet through the head. I remember it was a rainy night, and we were actually in bed. My mother, she just came in, she was crying, and she was just came and hugged each one of us, you know, and told us that your dad won't be coming back home. I remember asking her why, and she said, you got shot. Your dad is dead.
I'm Beulah Milton, the wife of Clinton Milton. I have suffered a great loss, the loss of my husband, from myself and my four kids. Course,
the news cameras came now, and they had an interview with my mom.
We had great plans for Christmas. We had planned to get a tricycle for Vivian and a dining room set for Dolores.
That's her voice.
A basketball for Clinton Jr.
I'd like to hear her voice.
Now how will I make this task by myself without some help from somebody?
Megger Evers, who was a field secretary of the NAACP at that time, wanted to bring national awareness to the Clinton Milton case, but Beulah felt that it could be dangerous and they could receive backlash.
She had lost her husband and she had these four children. You know, she didn't have no one to really depend on. So I'm sure that, you know, she was heartbroken. And I guess she was confused, too.
So the trial was set for March 1956. But just before then, days before the trial happened, Beulah Milton was driving, and her car ended up in the Black Bayou River.
She had her children in the car with her when she made a wrong turn and went out in the water.
My brother was 3 years old and I was five. We are in the car. The car is upside down. You know, you can feel the water just coming in. And my brother told me, he said, water getting in my face. And so I pulled him close up to me and I was feeling around because I was actually trying to open the door. But, you know, if you're upside down, everything is not in place. So I'm trying to feel the knob. And I felt my mom, but she wouldn't answer me. We didn't know how to swim. I was scared that we were going to drown. Finally, I heard my uncle and this other man come along, and he got us out. And I remember them taking my mom out, and she wasn't moving.
Headline, widow drowns as trial opens. A widow who was set to attend the trial of a white man accused of gunning down her husband drowned under mysterious circumstances last week. Two of Miss Melton's children, Dolores and Clinton Jr., were rescued without serious injury.
I was told later that we had been forced off the road, but they never did say who or what, but they were thinking that it was because my mom is going to attend the trial and somebody didn't want her there. Was that an accident or were we forced off of the road or what? I don't think nobody really investigated to see what actually happened to her. I would like to know.
When the Clinton-Melton trial began, it opened in the same courthouse where Till's murderers were tried just 5 or 6 months before. The same sheriff was on hand, the same lawyers were defending the defendants.
But maybe one of the most interesting connections was something that was not known at the time, that Elmer Kimball was an accomplice to the murder of Emmett Till. We now know Kimball was involved with both murders.
Kimball was also a manager at the Glendora Cotton Gin, where the Till murderers stole the fan that held Till's body in the river. But in both cases, the juries ignored evidence and there was a unanimous verdict, not guilty.
Well, it was more or less a mockery, I understand. It wasn't a really serious trial. They just went through the motion and did what white people would do during that period of time, a miscarriage of justice.
How could they sit there and know that this man had killed another human being and they still find him not guilty? I really don't like to say this because God moved that from my heart, but I had in my mind at that time that every white person I saw, that I would just like to just shoot them, let them see what it felt like. After my mom and dad died, my aunt, she adopted all four of us, and she had three children at home. My relatives on my dad's side, they wanted to split us up, and she said no, because we didn't want to be separated. We used to get together, and we often talked about that, what it would be like, you know, if our mom and dad was living. At times, I could actually picture the house where we lived in and everything that was in it. The bed, I remember the big heater that sat in the middle of the floor, in the kitchen table. I remember she had some red curtains at one of the windows. I remember that. At that age, you don't think you need these memories.
Dolores Melton Gresham, the daughter of Clinton and Beulah Melton. Today, Clinton Melton's name is engraved at the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama, honoring victims of lynching in the United States. This story was produced for Radio Diaries by Joe Richmond, with help from Sarah Kate Kramer and Nellie Gillis. It was edited by Deborah George and Ben Shapiro. Still to come, the World Almanac has a new book of facts ready for the new year. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand, anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Facts can be enlightening. They can also be inconvenient, infuriating, entertaining, and pretty darn funny. You'll find all of those facts and more in the new World Almanac and Book of Facts 2022. To find out more about this year's edition of the book, we've invited World Almanac Executive Editor Sarah Jansen back to the program. We started by talking about how the staff at the Almanac approaches each new edition of the book.
You know, it's really a year-long process to put together the World Almanac every year. So that means that even though we just shipped the copies of the World Almanac and Book of Facts 2022, we're already looking ahead to what the 2023 book is going to look like. Now, at the end of 2020, when we were starting the process, we knew that there were certain things that we were going to need to cover. We knew that there was an ongoing pandemic. We knew that there was going to be a new president inaugurated. We knew that Afghanistan was going to be a major story that needed to be covered in the upcoming year. But you don't really know the way that these things are going to take shape. Certainly, this last presidential inauguration looked quite different from previous inaugurations, for example, and so did the events surrounding it. So it's the kind of thing where you can make yourself a basic outline, but you know that you just kind of have to be flexible and stay on your toes and look ahead to the year while leaving yourself room for the many, many unpredictable things that happen over the course of 12 months.
When you get a major news story like the end of the Afghanistan war, does that make it a special thing where, well, let's just make this an historical section?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it was America's longest war. It wasn't always its most high profile war. You know, certainly, unless it hit very close to home, you maybe were not seeing, you know, it covered in the news even on a daily and sometimes weekly basis. So 20 years is a long time. And, you know, there are adults alive in the United States today and everywhere in the world, of course, that were not even born when the Afghanistan conflict began. So we wanted to make sure that we were putting it in its proper context, both, you know, from the beginning, but also how it progressed as a conflict under four different US presidents, looking at also the contributions from the coalitions and various nations that contributed to that over the years, and really just get, you know, the foundational data behind America's longest war and the way that it wrapped up in some sometimes surprising and disturbing ways.
And also one of the other big stories and elephants in the room is the pandemic. And it's something that you know you're going to be covering again in next year's book. How do you go about doing a story that's going to be different by the time the book comes out?
You know, that's always the eternal frustration of the Almanac editor. You know for sure that at the end of the day, the book has to be printed and then you just have to shake your head as news keeps developing beyond that final print deadline. But the good thing about being an Almanac editor is that you know you always have another book to put those developing stories in again down the road. So in the 2022 World Almanac, which is on sale now, you'll find a ton of data about the coronavirus pandemic in sort of a frozen in time sort of way. This is where we were in early November of 2021. We may see the same sort of feature in 2022, but I would not venture to predict that at this point because we really don't know what the next year is going to look like. I'm sure we will have something on the pandemic and a bunch of data, because there is so much data to go over when you when you're looking at this story. But I certainly would not be one to try to predict exactly where we'll be at this point next year.
If nothing else, this gives you job security.
I guess that's one way to look at it. I think, you know, it's definitely been a progression. You know, when we were covering the coronavirus pandemic for last year's book, it was, you know, something that we had sort of gotten used to over the course of the year since it began in March 2020, really in earnest in the United States. So that feature was more, you know, foundational, explaining the virus, explaining what scientists knew about it and hadn't yet, you know, found out. But when we were pressing print last year, there weren't even vaccines available yet. And now we're a year later. And of course, there are many vaccine options available, but there are also all of these, you know, new types to consider. And of course, every day, seemingly, there's a new data set for our editors to take a look at and see, you know, what are we seeing? What might we see going forward? So there's a ton of information out there. It's just a question of sifting through it all, making sure that we're vetting sources appropriately.
I see a special section here on recent sports scandals. When did y'all come up with that?
So this was actually inspired by the horse doping scandal of the spring. And we took a look back at some previous World Almanacs, and we actually found that a little under 20 years ago, previous World Almanac editors created a memorable sports scandals list, but we were looking at just the last 20 years and we had more than enough scandals to choose from. So we're basically inspired by our predecessors to do a more recent version of this sports scandals list. And that includes everything from horse doping to human doping to trash can banging. It's kind of a lighter take on the darker side of sports, I would call it.
What about the time capsule you talk about here? What are the items that come to symbolize the past year?
So the World Almanac's time capsule is totally theoretical. We're not, you know, running out to bury this anywhere, but it lets the World Almanac editors have a little bit of fun with the events of the year, and maybe with some that are not as, you know, serious or consequential as the very serious news topics that we cover from day to day. So this year's time capsule includes everything from the Pentagon's UFO report, which was highly anticipated but largely inconclusive, to a pair of Alex Trebek's shoes, which they were trying very, very hard to fill throughout 2021 with a succession of variously abled guest hosts. So these are some of the stories that we're paying attention to in 2021, but maybe are not the ones that will continue to have the greatest impact on the most people going forward.
With all the decisions you have to make about putting things in the book, how difficult are the decisions of what's got to go to make room?
Oh, it's very, very difficult. It's very difficult every year to take a look at our limited page space, just, you know, 1,008 pages every year, and decide, you know, what do we need to make room for? What do we not have room for anymore? It's always a balancing act. You know, for example, we know that we're going to have another set of Olympic Games, not even a full year after the last one. The Winter Olympic Games are coming up here in February. We know we're going to need to get, you know, all of the results, including all of the medal winners in there for those games. What do we need to cut in order to fit all of those new resources in? And the balancing act there is just, you know, a big logic puzzle, basically. We'll be working on that through most of the year and through the summer until we get things pinned down.
As you looked over your section of strangest news stories of the year, what stands out to you?
Oh gosh, there are so many weird ones this year. There always are. And they definitely are a nice distraction from some of the more serious topics that we cover. I think my favorite this year was one of these lemons into lemonade kind of scenarios where a candy store owner in Maryland decided, took a look around at all the cicadas that were swarming this summer and decided to use it as a seasonal ingredient. So she created a new confection. I believe they were $22 a dozen of chocolate covered cicadas, and they flew off the shelves, it sounds like.
Well, yes, they with flew off. I'm going to leave you right there.
Fair.
Sarah Jansen is the executive editor of the 2022 World Almanac Book of Facts. Students with disabilities are also students with ambitions. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
How do we help students with disabilities fulfill their career goals? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Susan McKelvey, research assistant professor at Virginia Commonwealth University, looks into this question.
For students with significant disabilities, career exploration and workplace readiness are often overlooked. The Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act of 2014 established new initiatives for vocational rehabilitation, or VR, agencies, such as Pre-Employment Transition Services, also known as PREETS. PREETS helps to prepare youth with disabilities by providing information to help them make informed post-secondary career decisions. The goal is to help them achieve a greater rate of competitive employment. State VR agencies, schools, and community providers collaborate to provide PREETS. Yet VR agencies struggle to find the most effective ways to deliver PREETS to youth with disabilities. To address this need, our research engaged families, educators, and VR counselors in Virginia and Kentucky in discussions on the delivery and impact of PREETS. These groups have similar views about the delivery of services to those early in their career planning process. In both states, educators and VR counselors would like more resources, such as ongoing training for providing PREETS to younger students, as well as training on specific disabilities. Families recommended making activities engaging by increasing job exploration and workplace experiences. Benefits of PREETS include increasing students' skills, knowledge, and understanding of employment. However, schools, VR counselors, and families must improve communication during the PREETS process. The groups also told us that COVID affected their ability to provide PREETS. While transportation and access to local businesses are often lacking, the pandemic exacerbated this problem. If students with significant disabilities have increased access to businesses and embedded strategies for early career awareness in their curriculum, they would have a greater chance at fulfilling their career aspirations.
That was Susan McKelvey of Virginia Commonwealth University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.